This is Life Stories, a Beatrice.com podcast focusing on memoirs and memoir writers. And I am here at the Putnam offices today with Jenny Lawson, the bloggess and the author of a memoir called Let's Pretend This Never Happened. And welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by talking a little bit about how you started blogging. What led you to this?
Well, you know, it's actually kind of funny because I think the assumption is that, you know, I started blogging first and then the book came about, but it actually was just the opposite. About 10 years ago, I started working on a book. And it was going to be a book that was really just for myself and possibly for my daughter because I have a terrible memory. And I wanted to record all of these memories of my childhood. So I started writing it, and it had like a big cover that basically said, no one is ever allowed to read this, this is just for me. And I had a really hard time forcing myself to write every day. So there was a blog that was on the Houston Chronicle, and there was a woman, and it was a parenting blog, and she basically said something like, you know, I don't think you can be a good mother and also a blogger, so I'm going to quit. And so I emailed the editor and basically said, I must be a terrible mother because I'll do it. I'll do it for free. And because I thought that that would give me an opportunity to feel like to write every day and to kind of find an audience and find my voice. And so I started writing for them. Then I started writing for my main blog now, which is The Bloggess, because I kept getting in trouble at the Houston Chronicle for writing really irreverent, borderline cursy things that, you know, nowadays people would look at and say, really? You can't say ass on the Houston Chronicle, but you could not say ass on the Houston Chronicle. So I started the bloggess just as a way for two or three of my friends to kind of keep up with what was really going on in my life that I didn't have to censor. And then years later, I'm still working on the book, and my agent found me. And when she found me, she basically said, I read your blog. I think there might be a book here. And I was like, I actually already have one. So sent her a couple of chapters, and she liked it.
And you know, you describe switching over from the Houston Chronicle blog to the bloggess as a way that, you know, like two or three of your friends could keep up with what was really happening. But, I mean, the audience for the bloggess is
millions.
Exponentially more than two or three people. So how did that snowball? I mean, when did you realize that it was snowballing like this?
Well, you know, it happened really slowly. But, you know, what I think happened, and I think kind of sets my blog apart, is if you read it, my posts are, they're funny and I think they're interesting, but if you read the comments are so much funnier than the post. My commenters are witty, they're smart, they're awesome. So if you read the post, you're missing the best half of the actual blog, which is all of the readers talking back and forth to each other. And I think it became much more of a forum than a blog. So instead, it became, instead of being this one weird girl writing this one weird story of her life, it became this one weird girl who would throw out a topic, and then suddenly all of these other weird people from around the world who were like, I thought I was the only one, could come and get together, and then suddenly everyone realized that these people are hysterical and funny and smart and brilliant in a very unique and different way. So it really was, I think, to me, more of a meeting ground for like-minded people.
And was there a post or a topic in particular where you noticed everything and kind of clicked and this had sprung into what it became?
You know, I want to say that the first time that the blog went truly, I would say, viral was, well, actually, it started several years ago. I had found this giant wild boar's head in an estate sale, and it was hanging from this cracked wall. It was missing a tooth. It was probably 100 years old. It was missing hair. It looked awful, but he had this giant smile, and he looked so happy, just so jolly. And I saw him, and I thought, we need him. That his name is James Garfield. He will live in our house. And my husband said, absolutely not. There's no way that's going to happen. We went around and around, and we finally left. And the entire rest of the week, anytime something good would happen, I would think, oh, James Garfield would have loved that. And finally, my husband Victor got upset enough that he went and bought this giant boar's head. So he brought it home, and I was so excited about it, and he would not stop talking about the fact that it had cost $90. He was like, I can't believe we just wasted $90. So I said, okay, this is what I need for you guys to do. I need 9 of you to buy a James Garfield Christmas card, and I will make a handmade Christmas card for $10. And it said, can I curse on this?
Yeah.
Okay. So it had the picture of this, you know, giant boar, and he's wearing all sorts of Christmas stuff. And then it said on the inside, it's about to get all kinds of motherfucking festive in here. You know, it was just so ridiculous. And I ended up selling a ton of them. James Garfield actually made more that month than I did. And what happened was the next year, when it came around to Christmas time, I had this money that I had made selling James Garfield Christmas cards and little James Garfield merchandise, you know, throughout the year. And Victor and I decided we should probably give back because we'd had a really good year. People were really suffering from the recession. So I sent a post out that said, since all this money came in from James Garfield and from you guys anyway, we want to help people who can't afford to buy Christmas or Hanukkah gifts for their kids. So if you leave a comment that just says, I need help, I can't afford it, then I will send you a $30 gift certificate to Amazon. And I said, and I'll do that for the first 20 people who say that they need it. So the first 20 people went super fast, and then the 21st person showed up, and the 22nd, the 23rd. So I went to talk to Victor, and I was like, we need to figure out a way to make some more money. And he was like, no problem. We'll move some stuff around. We'll, you know, make it work. But by the time that I got back to the computer, someone else, one of my readers, had said, I'll take the 21st person. And someone else said, I'll take the 22nd person. And someone else said, I'll take 23 through 25. And what happened was, all of these complete strangers offered to buy Christmas presents for all of these other complete strangers. We ended up raising over $42,000 worth of gift cards just based on, and there was not a single point when I was like, yeah, donate to this, or when no one covered it. There was nothing commercial that went on with it. No one got anything out of it whatsoever, except for just being able to help somebody else. And what was so nice is so many of the people, like, maybe they would say, I have 4 kids, so I would set them up with 4 donors. And they would email me back and say, listen, the first donor gave me more than enough for all of my kids, so I have these extra gift cards. Can I give them to the next person? And so people were giving and giving. Then the next year, which was this last Christmas, I had, the year before, I'd gotten really sick. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and if I work too hard, I get sick. So I'd made myself really sick by doing this, you know, unintentional thing. We call it the James Garfield Christmas Miracle. This year, I was like, I'm not going to do it this year. It's not what I do. I'm not the best person for it. Find the Salvation Army. But I kept getting these emails from people saying, no, we really want you to do it. And what I thought was so amazing is most of the people who were emailing me saying, please, please do this, were the same people who got money last year. And they just wanted a chance to pay it forward. And they were like, I'm so excited that I can this year do this. So instead, this year what we did was, there's a homeless project that helps homeless children. And it's called Project Nighty Night, and they give kids new canvas bags with a stuffed animal and a blankie and a book. And they were 750 short for the month of December. And so I was like, let's do that. It's cost $20 to sponsor a kid. Let's do that. And it absolutely worked. We got all 750 of them with more than enough time to spare. Project 99 was completely overwhelmed and so happy. And it was just so great to see something so wonderful happen with people had nothing to gain whatsoever, aside from, you know, just wanting to help. And it was the first time that I ever actually saw thousands of comments come in, and when I really realized how many people were out there that were listening who never before, you know, got to the point where they thought, oh, I need to leave a comment and I need to get involved.
And this is all from an online community where I'm imagining that because the amount of work that it takes to produce the posts themselves and your health issues, that you don't really spend a lot of time moderating this community.
Not at all, yeah. It's pretty much anything that anybody wants to post is going to end up going up online. And I'm really lucky that for the most part, I get mostly really positive, happy comments. Every once in a while, I'll get a negative one, but whatever. That's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen threads where you've sort of like added an addendum and like, you know, clarify things, but I've never seen you, you know, like, for example, another one of my favorite blogs is John Scalzi's Whatever.
Love him.
And he has the mallet of loving correction where he so actively moderates his threads and he flat out, and he's very upfront about it too, right, which is why it works.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I would, you know, sometimes every once in a while I'm like, I really wish I could do this because I feel like I'm missing, and especially because my commenters are so funny. I wish that there was a way that I could figure it out to where you could like rate the comments and they could, you know, be in order, but I have no, I'm technologically illiterate, which is so sad considering that that's where I make my living is pretty much online, but I have no idea what I'm doing. I just basically wing it and it works.
And the rheumatoid arthritis brings up another facet of the blog, which, and the memoir, which is interesting, is that, I mean, obviously, your reputation, your online legacy is for being funny, and yet the blog and the memoir are, yeah, I mean, you know, there's the rheumatoid arthritis, there's the social anxiety disorder, there's the blood thinning,
right,
blood
depression,
clotting,
depression, miscarriages.
So there is a lot of serious stuff going on in the stories that you tell.
Right, you know, I've always kind of felt like if I don't laugh at the things that are happening, especially the most tragic things, then they win. There have been very few points in my life when something happened that was so bad that I couldn't laugh at it. And whenever I get to that point, typically it's when I maybe have thoughts of self-harm or suicide. So really for me, humor has been a life raft. It's helped me to get through, because whenever I feel like there's no way that I'm going to be able to get over this, there's something so freeing and wonderful about writing a joke about something that seemed like this terrible monster that cuts it down to size and makes it something that you can deal with.
And circling back to James Garfield, you know, it's kind of ironically fitting that you should, you know, begin to have this sort of like thing for kitschy, you know, stuffed animals, considering that the early chapters of the memoir and I'm sure some of the blog posts are about, you know, basically your childhood being an ongoing series of traumatizing incidents involving stuffed and live animals, thanks to your father.
Exactly. You know, it's kind of funny because you know, my father is this taxidermist, and when I was growing up, I was just so mortified of, you know, people are going to know that my father sticks his hands up dead animals, and he was always, you know, covered with blood, and actually blood was like one of the best body fluids he was covered in, considering all the body fluids he was covered in. So you know, and I grew up thinking, oh, taxidermy, it's like, oh, what a terrible, you know, terrible sort of career. And now I have such a love for this particular type of taxidermy, which is this kind of anthropomorphic taxidermy, where specifically if it's a stuffed animal that is wearing clothes, I am all over that. And we, you know, my dad and I do, I think we've kind of bonded over that, but we do still have, you know, some things that we disagree about. I mean, my father's a very avid hunter and, you know, part of the NRA, and I support that. I mean, we wouldn't have eaten if my dad had not been a good hunter. But at the same time, all the stuff that all my taxidermied animals are ethically taxidermied. So basically they died of old age, or they're roadkill, or they, so, you know, it's interesting. It has kind of brought us together, but at the same time, we still have our own personalities.
Mm-hmm. And you share so much of your life through the blog and through the memoir. But I'm sure there must be sort of like corners or segments that even you would consider like, you know, too personal or you know, I'm not ready to share that yet.
There are several. One is I'm really hesitant and careful about what I share about my daughter, simply because she's seven and she's at an age where I don't think she can make that decision whether she wants to have her story shared or not. The rest of my family, before the book came out, I made sure that they read it, that they were okay with it, that they, you know, sort of remembered it the same way or at least close. But with my daughter, she's not old enough that I could share any really of those stories yet. So I do share a lot less about her. That was one of them. And I do, there's definitely some areas of mental illness that I'm just now kind of getting into and trying to do, you know, behavioral therapy and trying to get over. And some of them, like anxiety, to me, it's very easy to write about because I've been writing about it for years, and I feel like I'm, well, I don't have control over it. I still have panic attacks. I still feel like it controls me. I feel like I control the way that I react to it, and I've given myself permission that if I need to hide underneath the table sometimes, that I need to hide underneath the table, and that people are just going to either have to accept that or think I'm weird, and both of those people are right. So there are definitely some aspects, though, some mental illnesses that I wasn't comfortable with sharing quite as much. It was really hard for me when I wrote the book to not to write about anxiety because I'm comfortable with that, but it was very hard to write a serious chapter about what it felt like to have a panic attack because that's a trigger for me. So as soon as I would start to write a paragraph, I could start to feel my heart racing and then it would constrict and then I would have to make myself stop because I was going to have a panic attack, which is, it's a terrible trigger if you're a writer and mm-hmm. writing about something triggers it. But by the time that I actually got finished with it, it felt very therapeutic, and I felt like I had kind of conquered it a little.
And, I mean, I'm catching you on the first day of a book tour.
A scary day. I'm terrified.
But even before you're going out and facing, like, you know, or meeting, I should, you know, let's put a nice spin on it. You're meeting, yes. A lot, not facing.
Exactly. I see the line of fire. Mm-hmm. Great.
Meeting a lot of fans. But even before meeting these folks in person, I mean, you are already at a stage where a lot of people across the world feel like they know you.
Right, right. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword. In so many ways, it's wonderful, not only because I know that I've been able to help a lot of people, but also because, say, for instance, say I'm in a hotel room and it's the middle of the night and I start to have a panic attack and I need somebody to tell me it's going to be okay, I know I can go on Twitter and say, I'm not feeling well, I'm feeling really bad, I need somebody to tell me it's going to be okay. Like, even if you have to lie to me, just someone say it's okay. And I know 1,000 people are going to say, it's okay, I had the same thing yesterday, you're fine, you're great, don't worry about it, we know that you can do it. And there's something so wonderful about that. I have been really, really blessed with a couple of letters that I've gotten from people who were very near suicide and read some of my blog posts about suicidal thinking and depression and anxiety and all of those things that so many of us go through and decided not to kill themselves. And one actually was from a young mother. And I have those in a special folder, and I always tell myself that even if I never get paid anything for writing, that was enough. That was payment.
And you mentioned before about showing your family the book before publication and going through it with them. But even before then, I mean, fairly early on in the blogus stage, you and Victor must have had a talk about, I mean, how does he feel about basically being, you know, the Ricky Ricardo to your Lucy?
You know, that's a good analogy. It's kind of funny because you would think that he would be really involved in it, and he's so not involved in it. As a matter of fact, he seldom reads it, seldom reads the blog. I don't know that he has actually completely finished the book. I think he's kind of jumped around from place to place. And the way that he just kind of describes it is, he's like, as long as you're happy, go ahead and do whatever it is that you want. But it is interesting because now he'll get on a conference call with people that he works with, and they all read the blog, and he'll say something, and they'll all start laughing because they're thinking about something that he said in the blog, and he's like, what was in the blog? What did she say? What are you laughing at? So they're definitely, I think there are some lines that we've put in together, but for the most part, it really was just about Haley, about our daughter, about making sure that she was safe and me not sharing any information that might, you know, come back to haunt her or make her, you know, in some unsafe place. But for the most part, he's just kind of like, you know what, I knew you were insane when I married you. It's been 16 years. You haven't changed. None of this is going to change. We might as well just keep on going.
And where do things go from here? With the first memoir out, there are hints in the book that there might be a second volume, but it's hard to tell whether those are part of the running gag or not.
I am working on book two, and it took me 10 years to write this one, so hopefully this will take 9 or less. So, but I am working on a second book, and it's funny, starting a second book just reminded me just how terribly difficult it was to write this book. And don't get me wrong, I love writing, and especially I compare it to all the jobs that I've had in the past. I'm like, I can't believe I actually get paid to do this thing that I love. But at the same time, writing is lonely work. I mean, it's so quiet and lonely, and it's not until you actually get into your own brain that you realize how dark it can be in there. So I don't know. It's, to me, I think reading is therapy, writing is therapy, and everything that I've done so far with the book is therapy. And hopefully book two will be the second level of therapy, a little more behavioral therapy.
And who are some of the blogs that you read for fun?
My favorite blog is Hyperbole and a Half, who, unfortunately, has her own depression issues, and so she hasn't written in quite a while. I also read Chuckalunks and The Queso, Scalzi. I read Will Wheaton and Neil Gaiman. I am a pretty prolific blog reader. I'm not a good blog commenter, though, and it's funny now because if I leave a blog comment, I'll almost automatically get an email back that says, "You didn't really leave this, did you? It's just one of my friends just messing with me." And I have to like send another email and go, "No, I left your comment." Yeah, so now I just don't even leave comments. I just read and I'm like, "Oh, that's funny." And then I go away.
All right. Over the weekend, before the book came out, one of your friends' blogs you had mentioned, they threw you a surprise publication party. You had just thrown out a tweet about this, like, "Oh, you know, here's a blog post that a friend did about this party that they threw for me." And apparently you broke the internet.
I did break the internet. I felt very bad about that. I have to figure out, because Neil Gaiman has it at one point, you know, he linked to my blog and completely broke the blog. And then later he was like, "Oh, I found a way to fix it with some mirror, I have no idea what he was talking about." So I need to figure out like what that is. Because I have a tendency to, every time I'm like, "Everybody go look," I should say like, "Everybody whose last name starts with A through L, go look, then wait 10 minutes and then we'll start with the next letter," because I crash everything. And it was kind of funny because it was barely, maybe a couple of months ago, somebody wrote something that was not nice about me, but it was really funny the way that they wrote it. So I sent everybody, I was like, "You guys have to read this. It's really funny."
Is this the PR story?
It was the PR story.
We need to tell the whole PR story. We have time on the tape here.
Okay, all right. The PR story, I got an email that basically was, I think it was Kourtney Kardashian wearing pantyhose. I get a lot of pitches, and the pitches, like a good pitch would be, "Hey, I know you like taxidermied animals. I'd like you to, you know, review our taxidermied animal." I would look at that and be like, "Oh, you read my blog." And a bad pitch would be the one that I got from this company, which basically said, Kourtney Kardashian's wearing pantyhose. Pantyhose are awesome. And I'm like, well, okay, I've never written about Kourtney Kardashian. I don't like pantyhose. Why are you even sending this to me? So what I did was I asked Will Wheaton, who I didn't really know at the time, but I read his blog a lot, and I said, you know, I keep getting people that want to basically give me these pictures of celebrities doing random things because they think that that's some sort of payment to me, and I, you know, can't actually pay my mortgage with a picture of, you know, Selma Blair holding a scarf. So if I could get a picture of you doing something random, like collating, I could send it back to them, and then they'd be like, why would you send me this? And I'd be like, exactly, why would you send me this? Like, no one cares. So, and he did. He totally did. He made this whole picture of himself collating. So I made this website that basically said, hi, you've just sent a blogger a picture of a celebrity doing something random that no one gives a shit about. And so we're going to return the favor. Here's a picture of Will Wheaton collating. And then it had other things like, or maybe you got this sent to you because you called me David and my name is Jenny. Or maybe it's because you get these terrible pitches. So it became this iconic sort of site that if you get a terrible pitch, you send somebody to that site just to tell them, wow, you really need to do your research. So I got the thing about Kourtney Kardashian wearing pantyhose and I was like, thanks, I'll see you that and I will raise you Will Wheaton collating paper. And I got a response from the company who said, well, I guess, you know, if we ever have money to spend, we'll keep in mind that you're not interested in it. And I was like, okay, well, that's a fair thing to say, you know. And I just left it alone. I was like, it's not nice, but that's fair. And the person who wrote it had CC'd the executives. Well, one of the vice presidents replied all with me on it and said something like, what a fucking bitch. And I was like, oh, that didn't just happen. That didn't just happen. So I write this email response to everyone thinking, and I, like, for me, I thought it was pretty nice. It was, you know, like, I get it. We've all accidentally hit reply all. However, you have sent this to me twice. I've asked you to remove me twice. I've never, you know, so I explained the whole thing. And at that point, I still wasn't even angry. I had sent a tweet out about, you know, some executive replied all and called me a bitch. It's kind of funny, whatever. And I was just going to let it go. And then the same guy replied back and said, well, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have said that, but maybe you should just be happy that you were viewed as even relevant enough for us to pitch to you. And there was something about that that was so, first of all, completely insulting. And secondly, I just thought, okay, you would say that to any blogger. You obviously don't take bloggers seriously. And if somebody, like, if I would have gotten that 2-3 years ago, it would have crushed me. And I would have thought, oh, you're totally right. I should just take anything that you know, send to me. And instead I thought, you know what? This is a bunch of bullshit. And it's not gonna stand. So I went ahead and put it out on the internet and said, here are the exact emails that came out. And by the way, the reason I'm doing this is not so everybody can go all like Frankenstein's monster and like wave your pitchforks, because that's not what this is for. But the reason why I did it is because I want new bloggers and bloggers who are hesitant and bloggers who think, oh, maybe that is what I should do. Maybe I should just post whatever it is somebody gives to me. I want you to know that there are good PR people out there and there are bad PR people out there, and you shouldn't let them shame you into using you for bad purposes. And it hit a major nerve, because so many people, first of all, it's just a funny story that we've all hit reply all accidentally. So anybody could relate to it. I felt bad for the guy personally for like a minute until he sent me the, you know, be glad you're relevant enough. And then I was like, oh, I don't feel sorry for you anymore. Changed my mind. It's all fair game. So it was interesting.
Yeah, and like you say, it pretty much took off like that. I remember that afternoon. You know, if that PR firm had publicly traded stock, it would have plummeted.
Oh my gosh! And you know, it was really funny. I mean, it got covered by, I think, like Fortune covered it, and I think I want to say maybe CNN covered it. Like a ton of big companies covered it, and I just walked away from it. I didn't didn't leave any quotes. I was just like, okay, we're moving on because this is becoming, you know, kind of a witch hunt thing, and I don't want that to happen. And I really tried with the company, even like I worked with one of the main people, and I was like, you know, really what you need to do is you just need to say, that's not what we believe. We believe bloggers are important, and we're going to take this as a learning opportunity. Like, that's what you need to say. But instead it was, you know, oh, we think you'd really get along with this guy. He's really funny, and he didn't know who you were when he said that. And I was like, oh, that makes it so much worse. No, it doesn't matter who I am. I'm a person. Like, treat every person in a nice way. Like, who gives a crap that I was able to, you know, make your company look like an idiot because you didn't do your research first? I mean, you shouldn't have done that to anyone.
This is something that, you know, began as an intensely personal project for you. And, you know, whether you want it to be a, you know, a business or not, I mean, it really kind of has taken on the aspect of, you know, it's kind of become a career for you.
It has. And, you know, what's kind of interesting is, in the past, I was able to, you know, you have this platform and you can say whatever you want to say, which is fun and, you know, it's sort of exciting, and you feel like, I wouldn't say like a power trip, but you feel like you have this voice that you never had before. So that was great. But at the same time, now I'm at a point where I have to be so careful. I can't sometimes say the things that I really want to say because I know that they can take off and take their own life. And I had someone, I guess it was maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago, someone was on Goodreads and they reviewed my book. They gave me a 1 star. I hated it, which is a totally legit, like, I can totally see where some people would read the book and be like, I didn't like it. That's going to happen. But I read the review, and the review said, I looked at the cover and no. So basically she like judged the book by its cover, literally. And wrote that, you know, I have friends that would burn this book because of what's on the cover, and that, you know, I mean, it was just so.
And let's keep in mind, folks, that what is on the cover is a tiny taxidermy stuffed mouse dressed up as Hamlet.
Exactly. Now, of course, the thing that I think she was upset about was that there on the back there is a an attribution by Jesus. Although there is a little asterisk that down at the bottom explains that is my hairdresser and his name is Jesus and they pronounce their names differently. But she was not so happy. That's what I'm thinking it came from. So I was thinking that, you know, on Goodreads, you leave your comment and then your comment's just there and whatever. So I thought nothing about going on Twitter and saying, this is really funny. I think it'd be really funny if they use this on the blurb for like whenever the paperback comes out, you know, great for book burnings. But I didn't realize that people could comment on her comments. And, you know, for the most part, everybody was nice, but there were a couple people that were really sort of harsh, and I felt like, oh, I don't want to feel like I have to defend people who are saying bad things about me. But at the same time, there is a certain amount of responsibility that comes with the power to really, you know, hurt somebody. And so you do have to be careful, and that's kind of what I'm learning now.
Mm-hmm. So with great power comes great responsibility. So
as
basically,
Peter
you've
Parker
turned
said,
into Spider-Man.
I'm Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I'm Spider-Man. I'm not quite as cool as I am Batman, but it's close.
Great. Well, we have been talking with Jenny Lawson, the author of Let's Pretend This Never Happened and the creator of The Blog S, one of the more popular personal voice blogs out there. And this has been Life Stories. I'm Ron Hogan, and thanks for listening.